We'd like to start the program today by talking about an issue that's been a hot topic on Capitol Hill lately. That issue is pay equity. The Democrats have been trying to push legislation through Congress to address what they say is a gender wage gap where women earn less than men for the same work. Yesterday, President Obama signed two orders aimed at closing that gap. One will require federal contractors to disclose information about employee compensation to the Labor Department in broad categories by race and sex. Another will allow employees to discuss compensation with co-workers without retaliation. Here's a clip of the president's remarks.
Today, the average full-time working woman earns just 77 cents for every dollar a man earns. For African-American women, Latinas, it's even less. And in 2014, that's an embarrassment. It is wrong. And this is not just an issue of fairness, it's also a family issue and an economic issue, because women make up about half of our workforce.
Here to tell us more about what these orders could mean going forward is Joe Davidson. He writes the Federal Diaries column for The Washington Post. He's with us from his newsroom. Joe, thanks for joining us once again.
Thank you.
Also joining us is Romina Baca. She looks at federal budgetary affairs for the Heritage Foundation. That's a conservative research and policy organization. She's also with us from the studios at her office. Romina, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you for having me.
So, Joe, let's just start with you. This does not affect the entire workforce in the country, correct? This is only federal contractors.
That's correct. There's legislation on the Hill that would do what these, what this executive order and these presidential memorandums seek to do for companies and other organizations. But this, what the president did yesterday, applies only to federal contractors. However, that's not necessarily a small group. The reach of federal contractors really extends throughout the economy, and so it is not insignificant.
Why does the president say this is necessary? Is there some data to show that women, even doing the same work in the same job categories, are being paid less than men?
Yes, there is data on that. The figure that the White House uses is that women make 77 cents for every dollar that men make. The Department of Labor uses the figure 81 cents. But those figures are in dispute. They are aggregate figures, and they don't look at really occupation by occupation, which I think is really the point. But if you do look at the Labor Department data, they have a report out called Highlights of Women's Earnings. The last one was in 2012. And they do break it down by education. So, for example, management professional and related occupations, that's the first line in this report, that indicates that women's earnings are 71.6% of men's earnings. And so when you break it down like that, I think you get a more accurate picture than what either the 77% figure or the 81% figure provides.
Why is the president taking this route? I understand that, as we mentioned earlier, the Democrats are pushing a Paycheck Fairness Act, which you said would be more broadly applied. So why is the president taking this course of action now?
Well, he has the ability to do this for federal contractors by executive action, but it takes legislative action to do it across the board, And that legislation has been stalled on the Hill. The Republicans don't like it, as the president pointed out yesterday. He cited them, the Republican Party specifically. And so it's stalled. And so this is his, quote, year of action. And so when he finds that he can't get things through Congress that he wants to do, he will do them by executive action to the extent that he's able.
Joe, I'm going to ask you to stand by because we're not asking you here to defend the president's conduct or his actions or his point of view here, just to explain it to us. But there is another point of view on this, and Republicans have been very vocal in opposing this particular direction. So I'm going to bring in Romina and ask you, you say these orders do more harm than good. Explain that point of view.
Mm-hmm. So first of all, it's important to recognize there's two orders. The first one actually doesn't do anything new. It's more of a political messaging device because workers actually already have the right to discuss their own salaries and benefits with their coworkers. But workers are protected from having other coworkers disclose their salaries in a public fashion that they might not agree with, like posting it on Facebook if they don't want that. So that executive order doesn't do a whole lot. It's more messaging than anything. The other one, however, is a bit more troubling. Now, what it would do is it would require that federal contractors supply the Labor Department with more information on their employees, including by sex and race. Now, that on the face of it doesn't sound like it could be too harmful, but I think what the White House also learned the hard way is that these summary statistics can be very misleading, and they can imply discrimination where none exists. Like the White House found that it's now being accused of paying its women 88 cents on the dollar for men, once again looking at this very misleading aggregate statistic and not accounting for important factors. Like,
well, but the Heritage Foundation. Excuse, can I just ask you for a minute? The Heritage Foundation is one of the groups that distributed that information. So if you felt that it was misleading, why do it?
So the information actually came from the American Enterprise Institute. And what it looks at is it does the same analysis as the 70 cent to the dollar statistic does. It just takes the median woman, compares it to the median men, and doesn't account for any of the important factors that go into what people earn, including what occupation they choose, how much education they have, how much hours they spend on the job, how much time they spend in the workforce. And I think one of the great studies that the Labor Department did on this looked at 50 peer-reviewed academic studies, and they concluded that the differences in the compensation of men and women are pretty much the result of many different factors, and discrimination, if anything, plays a very, very small role.
Well, let me ask you this, Romina, then. Wouldn't that be an argument for more reporting, not less, so that you could determine those questions at a more granular level?
So there is reporting out there. The risk with these new requirements that the Labor Department would impose for now just on federal workers, but which the Paycheck Fairness Act would extend to all employers, is that when businesses have Uncle Sam scouring over their employee composition, looking at things like race and gender, and trying to draw conclusions from that may not necessarily have anything to do with discrimination, but other factors, what it does, it encourages employers to adopt more rigid pay structures, and that can mean less flexible working conditions, which will particularly hurt parents and working moms. It also can mean less performance-based pay, fewer bonuses or raises for performance, because if you pay everyone the same and you don't pay them based on performance or try to encourage them with a spot bonus, for example, or give them specific conditions that they appreciate, like being able to leave at 4 o'clock to see their son's soccer game, you can more easily justify paying everyone the same.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about two executive orders signed by President Obama yesterday that address issues of unequal pay for federal contract workers. We're talking about this with Romina Baca of the Heritage Foundation. That's a conservative research and a policy organization that is critical of this effort. And Joe Davidson of the Washington Post, who's been reporting on this, is also with us to explain more. So, Joe, let me go back to you on that. I mean, presumably the White House has heard these arguments, and what has their response been to that?
Well, they say that these two executive actions are necessary in order to promote equal pay for equal work. I think they're well aware that they will take fire and have been taking fire from the right on this. And some of that is due to these aggregate stats that they're using, like the 77%, which is certainly, I think, open to criticism. I also think, however, that those on the right, Republicans who attack this, need to tread very carefully, because it's difficult for them if they're going to sound like they are against equal pay for equal work. And, of course, they say they are not. But in this political climate, the Republicans have made a point to try to improve their image, if you will, in a number of ways, and certainly among the female voters is one of those ways. And so to the extent they come out vigorously against this, I think they risk hurting themselves politically.
Joe, I have one more question for you, but I want to go back to Romina on this just for one more question. Is there a better idea? Do conservatives have a better idea about encouraging federal contractors or other employers, for that matter, to offer competitive pay, but also ensure that women and other groups are treated fairly?
So there are protections in place. They have been for the past 50 years. The Equal Pay Act of 1963 is a great example of this. But I think what is most empowering to women and men in the workforce is to have more opportunities, greater opportunities. So the first thing is that Washington should do no more harm and not discourage employers accommodating, for example, their female employees who may desire more flexible working conditions or more benefits, and they make these trade-offs. the risk that we face now is that Washington is overshooting. I think it's very important to recognize equal pay for equal work and to make sure that women are respected in the workforce. And I think they are, and we've made great strides. And now I'm actually more afraid that we're going to do more harm by reducing opportunities. And I think the best leverage a woman can have to negotiate for higher pay is to have another job opportunity.
Okay. Let me just give Joe Davidson one more question. This is something that you wrote about, that the president has to this point been asked to sign a similar order banning discrimination against gays and lesbians in the federal workforce. He has declined to do that. Why is that?
You know, that's a mystery, because it's a mystery because he's really had a very good record when it comes to gays and lesbians and public policy. He was against DOMA, which prohibited recognition on the federal level of gays and lesbians marriages. So he's taken much more controversial stands on behalf of public policies that would benefit gays and lesbians. So why he is hesitant about issuing an executive order that would prohibit discrimination by contractors against gays and lesbians and bisexuals and transgenders, it's a mystery to everyone I've talked to. When I talked with the White House about it, pressed them on it, they really don't offer any explanation that's concrete. So the answer to your question is it's a mystery.
Joe Davidson writes the Federal Diaries column for The Washington Post. He was kind enough to join us from the studios there. Romina Bacha is a fellow with the Heritage Foundation. She focuses on federal budgetary matters. She joined us from the studios at the Heritage Foundation. Thank you both so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This spring, we're joining our colleagues at Morning Edition to take a closer look at paying for college. So far in this series, we've talked about navigating the mountains of paperwork, whether working during school is a good idea, and if so, how much is too much. And we've also talked about the huge debt that many students faced after graduation. But imagine if all those worries went away. What if the city you lived in footed the bill for college? Kalamazoo, Michigan is doing that. In 2005, a group of anonymous donors pledged enough money to pay the tuition at any of Michigan's public universities and community colleges for every student who graduated from the district's public high schools. They called it the Kalamazoo Promise. Nearly a decade later, that promise is bearing fruit, and sometimes in unexpected ways. Here to tell us more is Erica Adams. The Kalamazoo Promise paid for her to attend Michigan State University. She graduated in 2012 and is now a foster care specialist for the state of Michigan. Erica, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Michelle Miller Adams. She is a research fellow at the W.E. Upjohn Institute for Employment Research and author of the book, The Power of a Promise, Education and Economic Renewal in Kalamazoo. We believe it's the only book so far written about the Kalamazoo Promise. Thanks so much for joining us, Michelle Miller Adams.
Thank you, Michelle. Glad to be here.
So I'm going to start with you. This is a very unique program for the United States, isn't it? In that it's not need-based, it's not merit-based, it's based on where you live, and it's designed to go on forever, presumably if the money holds up. So how did this begin? What did the donors have in mind?
Well, it's hard to ask them because they're anonymous, and thus far they haven't been willing to talk. But we can infer a lot about their intentions from the design of the program. They were clearly looking for the big move, for a transformative investment that would change not only the school district that serves our city, which is a high-poverty school district that had been shrinking for many years, many decades, in terms of enrollment, but also something that would transform the broader community.
And how so? By what? Encouraging kids to go to college who wouldn't think that they could go? Encouraging kids to go to more competitive schools? What were they hoping for, to the degree that we can determine it?
I think they were hoping for all of those things. I think they were also hoping to really strengthen and reinvigorate the school district that serves the urban core of our region. And they were also seeking to make Kalamazoo a more attractive place for people to live and work, especially those people who value education. They wanted to make Kalamazoo stickier. That's a term we hear a lot. Harder to leave, more welcoming to come to.
So, Erica Adams, you were a sophomore in high school when the Kalamazoo Promise launched. Do you remember how you felt when you heard it? I mean, did you think at the time it would have an effect on your life?
Yes, I was extremely excited. I had always knew that I wanted to go to college, but it definitely just broadened all the opportunities as to where I could go. And it also kind of helped me to do exactly what I wanted to do rather than what was going to be feasible for me and what, you know, I could afford, like as opposed to a community college or something of that nature.
That was going to be my next question. Did it change where you went to school and did it change what you decided to study?
Absolutely. Before I probably went to a university that was a little bit smaller where tuition would have been a little bit cheaper or a community college. I also probably would have did nursing or something like that just because I know those are jobs where typically when you graduate, you can find jobs easily. Programs are somewhat structured to where you can graduate in a quick time frame. So when the promise was announced, I was like, you know, Big Ten universities, here I come. So it definitely completely changed everything. I was actually able to do something that I like, which is working with people.
So you think that you were able to choose what you really wanted to do for your career as opposed to worrying about having to get a job?
Yeah. Exactly. And also just go to a school that had, you know, one of the top 10 programs for, you know, what I was trying to go for in the nation.
Michelle Miller-Adams, you've been tracking the progress of the Kalamazoo Promise, as we mentioned, since it began. How does Erica's story fit in with the other students that you followed?
It's a perfect illustration of some of the benefits of the Promise that are not well understood. We tend to focus on kids who weren't going to go to college and now can go to college. The reality of the impact is much more complex than that. Students are able to choose different colleges. We see this trading up phenomenon. We sometimes see, I hate to call it trading down, but we see a shift in college preferences because of the requirement that you attend a public in-state institution. But, you know, that's quite good for the state that more of our top students are being driven to public in-state institutions. But we also see a great deal of freedom that students are experiencing in being able to follow their passion, and most importantly, graduating with either no or very low levels of debt. And that opens up a huge range of possibilities. That opens up the possibility of graduate school for a lot of students. So the impacts are really pretty subtle and nuanced.
You know, Erica, you were also telling us that it's made a difference in the college culture in school, if that makes sense, that you were saying that when you were coming along, when you were growing up and going to school, the teachers really only started talking about college when it was SAT time. But now there's a college-going culture in the schools. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Absolutely. You know, growing up, my junior and senior year, you know, they started to talk about a little bit more when it was test taking time, you know, just letting us know that, you know, in the counseling office, you can get this fee waived for this application. In my job, I deal a lot with teenagers in the foster care system. And just the other day, I was at one of our middle schools. And as soon as you walk into the office, there's a huge check on the wall, and it says, I think like $50,000 on it, says, put your name here. And that's typical of all my school visits I do. The first thing you're hit with when you walk into the building is a banner saying you are Kalamazoo Promise eligible, you are going to college. Rather than back when I was going to school, before the Promise was announced, teachers weren't really asking, well, what school are you going to after graduation? Or, you know, what are you going to major in? It was, what are your plans after graduation? Whereas now it's teachers telling you, like, hey, what school are you going to? So it completely just changed the mindset that I think a lot of our administrators have, our educators and our kids have in our community.
But, and I would add that that's ahead, even happening at the elementary school level. I have a daughter who's been in Kalamazoo Public Schools elementary school for about 5 years. And that college-going culture and attitude and expectations penetrates all the way down to kindergarten.
Michelle, though, you were telling us that overall, though, the graduation and dropout rates have been slow to change. Why do you think that is?
Yeah, I think that's one of the surprises that we find in the data. I think that we will see it change. This is a very long-term program. You pointed out in your introduction, it's set up to continue in perpetuity. And, you know, we're only really 8 years into it in terms of eligible classes. The reality is that if you have things going on in your life, either academically or more importantly in your home life, that are keeping you from being successful in school, that have kept you from being with your grade level in terms of your achievement levels, the Kalamazoo Promise does not change those things. It doesn't take away a precarious home life or insecure housing or lack of access to food or really poor support in the home for your learning. But I also, you know, particularly around the issue of dropping out, I think that one can predict, I mean, the data show that you can predict whether a student is going to drop out or not really quite early. It has to do with things that happen earlier in your academic career than, you know, what happens to hit in ninth grade or when you turn 16 and can drop out. And the reality is that we are still a very high poverty district in a high poverty city, and kids, as Erica knows from her work, experience tremendous stresses. And so it's not that none of those kids can overcome those, but it is a lot harder for those students to really stay in school, be successful, and make full use of the promise. Lots of them are trying.
Erica, final thought from you?
In my opinion, it has completely just changed just the outlook of a lot of kids in our community, even from my family. I mean, I come from a middle-class family, but, you know, $200,000 is, I mean, it's just a whopping number, and it really teaches the kids about paying stuff forward, just doing the right thing and, you know, coming back and doing things for the community because it's the right thing to do. And I think it kind of just lets all the kids know, too, that there's somebody out here that thinks that I'm worthy of having this education regardless of my family situation, what class we are. The stipulations for the promise are not you have to have a 3.5 GPA and all these extracurricular activities, and you have to just have the, you know, the willpower to do it. And that's pretty much it. And I just think that that's an amazing blessing that, you know, somebody or a group of people put that much faith in this community. It's just a complete blessing.
Erica Adams is a beneficiary of the Kalamazoo Promise. She's now a foster care specialist for the state of Michigan. She joined us from member station WMUK in Kalamazoo, Michigan, along with Michelle Miller Adams, who is a research fellow at the W.E. Upjohn Institute for Employment Research and author of the book, The Power of a Promise, Education and Economic Renewal in Kalamazoo. Thank you both so much for speaking with us.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks.
Just a reminder, you can weigh in with your own story or question about paying for college on Twitter at hashtag paying for college. Now we'd like to talk about seniors and technology. And when I say that, what comes to mind? Is it you helping grandma figure out how to Skype? Or is it the savvy grandma of all those TV commercials of late who tweet and blog about what's going on? Well, a new study by the Pew Research Center's Internet Project debunks some of the myths and gives us a glimpse into just how older adults are using technology in their lives. Aaron Smith is a senior researcher with the Pew Center's Internet and American Life Project, and he's with us now in Washington, D.C. Welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So the first myth I think that a lot of people have, or impression that a lot of people have, is that older people just don't use technology, apart from the kinds of seniors that we see highlighted on TV commercials who are on Facebook or Twitter. But the study says that seniors' use of technology really depends on income. Could you tell us about that?
Absolutely. So we actually see a lot of diversity in the senior population when it comes to technology. On the one hand, you have some very tech-savvy folks. They go online, they do a lot of activities on there, and they've internalized the technology in their lives and really value it for what it gives them. On the other end of that spectrum, you have some people who I think match up with a lot of our stereotypes. They're very disconnected from technology. They don't see the value in it, and they would need a lot of assistance to learn how to use it.
So the critical factor here is not age. It's what?
It's a combination of age and socioeconomic factors. And what's very interesting is that those are a lot of the factors that we see at play in the broader population as a whole. So just like we talk about in the broader population, digital divide issues centering around age and income and education, we very much see that in the senior population as well. So those disconnected seniors tend to be older. So in internet usage and a lot of technology measures drop off pretty dramatically at about age 75. They tend to be higher income and they tend to have higher levels of education. And that's in many ways somewhat ironic because those folks that are disconnected from technology are in many cases the people who could benefit most from what it allows them to do.
From the report, among seniors with an annual household income of $75,000 or more, 90% go online and 82% have broadband at home. I think that is surprising to some people to find out that there is that level. It's nearly universal.
Absolutely. And both of those are significantly higher than we see in the population as a whole. So for certain seniors, they're as tech savvy, if not more tech savvy, than what we see in the broader population.
For seniors earning less than $30,000 annually, 39% go online and 25% have broadband at home.
Absolutely. So when you look at the flip side of that, which is those folks with low levels of income, low level levels of education, the older end of the older adult spectrum, and the fourth factor that we haven't mentioned yet is people with disabilities. A number of seniors, about a quarter of the senior population, has a physical condition that makes reading challenging, and a similar number have a health condition or disability that makes it challenging them for them to do certain physical activities. So that's another issue where, in many cases, older adults just have physical limitations in terms of what they can do with the technology, and we see very low levels of tech use among folks with those disabilities or health conditions as well.
Now, one idea I think a lot of people have is that a motivator for seniors to use technology is to stay in touch with family. But is that true? I mean, is staying in touch the primary driver of staying connected to technology, or is it other things?
It really falls into two categories. So first of all is exactly that, connections with family members and more broadly sources of social support. And that's very important for a population that in many cases struggles with, you know, physical mobility and social isolation. The second element that we see in terms of benefits to older adults in particular is just access to information. So when we talk to older adults who do use the internet, overwhelmingly, they say that it helps them find information that they didn't have access to before, and that people who don't have internet access are at a disadvantage because they're missing out on important sources of information. So certainly among the people who have sort of gotten over that adoption hump, we see that both of those as very big factors driving that usage.
One of the things that surprised me from the report is that more than half of Americans now have a smartphone. But among older adults, adoption level is just at 18%. So that's interesting. So the smartphone is the access to technology that I think most people have. In fact, a lot of very young people have them. Why do we think that is, that smartphone adoption lags? And while you're answering that, maybe you could tell me which technology seniors prefer.
So about three quarters of seniors have cell phones. So it's not that they're necessarily leery of cell phones per se, but you're absolutely right that very few of them have a smartphone at this point. And part of that is just that older adults tend to be at the end of the adoption curve when it comes to picking up new technologies. But, you know, it also goes back to these very real sort of physical limitations that older adults have using technology. If you have trouble reading, it may be very difficult to read a 3-inch smartphone screen. And so what we actually see is that more seniors have a tablet computer or an e-reader than have a smartphone, which is sort of the exact opposite of what we see in the population as a whole. So if you are someone who has trouble reading or maybe has trouble manipulating a small screen, that larger form factor can maybe overcome a lot of those challenges.
It's interesting because that's not how those are advertised. Right? Have you noticed that they don't seem to generally advertise those as a benefit to older people?
Well, maybe we've just found them a new market.
We should find them a new market. Finally, how do minorities fit into this picture? I mean, one of the things that we've learned from Pew's previous studies is that minorities over-index in use of mobile devices, that they're more likely to have a mobile device than the rest of the population. Do we have any sense of how this plays out with a minority population?
You know, we don't necessarily see that with seniors yet. Seniors, by and large, once you control for things like education, income, and age, you know, really sort of look the same, whether they're black or white or male or female or urban or rural. Really those, you know, the sort of socioeconomic age and sort of health and disability factors are what in many cases are really driving a lot of these adoption issues.
Since you've been following this for a long time, do you mind if I ask, is there something that really stood out in this report for you?
The thing that stood out for me is just it's a reminder of just how diverse all of these different populations are. So we grow very accustomed to thinking of, you know, seniors as this monolithic group of people who are, you know, in many cases not very connected or not very tech savvy. And so we kind of have, you know, a laugh at that in popular culture and so forth.
I've even seen commercials that have played on that, the idea that, you know, seniors that need, you know, the kids to kind of tell them what's what and you're telling us what.
Absolutely. And what you really find is that there's a whole diversity of experiences, you know, within the population as a whole and with, you know, specifically seniors as well. And, you know, it's worth bearing in mind that as we talk about all of these groups and their experiences that we keep that diversity in mind in terms of, you know, how we serve them, how we treat them, and how we, you know, kind of interact with them in our day-to-day lives.
Aaron Smith is a senior researcher with the Pew Center's Internet and American Life Project. He was kind enough to join us in our Washington, D.C. studios. Aaron, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
If you're interested in issues like income inequality or other things pertaining to social justice, then you probably know the name Barbara Ehrenreich. She spent her life searching for answers. She's written nearly 24 books about things like poverty and underemployment, including the bestseller Nickel and Dimed on Not Getting By in America. But her latest book is about searching for answers within herself. The book is titled Living with a Wild God, A Nonbeliever's Search for the Truth About Everything. And Barbara Ehrenreich is with us now. Welcome. Thank you so much for joining us once again.
Oh, glad to be with you.
You said you didn't want to write a memoir or an autobiography.
No.
How would you describe it?
All right. Here's my, biggest promotional thing to say about it. I like to think of it as a little bit of a metaphysical thriller. I start with a question. As a child, I start with a question, what's going on here? Why are people born and then go through all this stuff and then die? What's this all about? And that question, one way or another, motivates me all the way through some very strange events.
I want to get you to tell us about some of those strange events, but you describe yourself as a fourth-generation atheist.
Yep.
And I wanted to ask if you would just set it up by telling us, why are you a fourth-generation atheist? How did it happen
I'll tell you the family story, right?
Uh-huh.
From my father. These are people who were mostly copper miners, railroad workers, the men in my family, in western Montana, in Butte, Montana. And my father had a grandmother, possibly a great-grandmother. When her father lay dying, she sent for a priest to administer the last rites. She got back a message that the priest wouldn't come unless she could pay him $25, which was completely beyond them. So that was the end, really, for my family. A couple of years later, she lay dying herself, a young woman in childbirth, and the priest showed up. And he hadn't been asked, but he showed up. There was a crucifix placed on her chest for the last rites. And according to my father, with her dying breath, she grabbed that crucifix and threw it across the floor. Now, that's a heavy legacy. You know, you don't betray that.
And it was also, but you also describe it as both a kind of a suspicion of all authority, you know, that you
yes.
kind of inherited of, you know, bosses,
lawyers,
of lawyers, a government, of like
doctor,
suspicions
yeah.
of all kind of authority. But I did want to ask if you wouldn't mind reading a passage from the book about how you grew up.
It wasn't easy being a child atheist during the Great Cold War, or for that matter, probably any time in human history outside of a few short-lived communist states. At school, I tried to blend in by mouthing the Lord's Prayer along with everyone else, which was mandatory in those days in the public schools, only sometimes permitting myself to slip into inaudible mocking gibberish. But I could not hide my peculiarity on Wednesday afternoons, when all the other kids were bussed off to what was called religious study at various churches, while I remained behind at my desk under the grudging supervision of a teacher who might otherwise have been free to leave. There were times when I was taunted after school for being a, quote, communist, which I understood only as a derogatory term for atheist. Once some boys picked up rocks and chased me home, but I outran them. How would I have turned out if I had not been set apart by this irreconcilable difference? If when I had first started asking why, I had been given that great non-answer, God. I like to think that I would not have been satisfied and would have persisted, taking my question why right up to him. But then again, maybe I would have ended up as some denatured version of myself, content with whatever anodyne explanation was being handed out.
As you describe it, you've been on a quest for why ever since. I mean, you started with science. Your father, for example, who through scholarships was able to kind of get out of the mines, and you were interested in science yourself. You've been a science writer, too. And you also talk about you're kind of interested in other religions. But why do you think the why is so important to you? Always was.
It's not only why. It could also be put as what is going on. You know, what is the situation that we are in? I can't explain it. That's just burns in me. And it can take me to science. It could take me to the study of history, religion, of anthropology, whatever.
You describe something in the book, and one of the pleasures of the book is revealing what this experience is that has also been something you have not talked about, written about recently. You call it altered states of consciousness. Other people have called these kind of spiritual experiences. Do you want to talk about that?
I don't like the word spiritual. I'll just say that.
I would say other people call it that.
I don't know. You know, it started when I was 13 and came to a sort of a climax when I was 17 in an experience that I much later learned had a term, and that is that it was a mystical experience. I don't think that's a great phrase, but it's the best I can do. And I didn't know at the time that it had ever happened to anybody else. Now I think it's fairly common. But I will say I was outdoors, very overtired, etc. Suddenly the world flamed into life. It's like something was rushing at me from all directions. It was beautiful and it was terrifying. It gave me a feeling of completion and a feeling of being shattered. That's the best, almost the best I can do in decades of trying to find some words.
And you describe this in the book, that there are people who have psychological explanations for this. You find those unsatisfying?
No, I lay out here plenty of possible clues or whatever explanations. You could say childhood difficulties. I was very solitary, introverted, thoughtful kid. You could talk about various physical and chemical changes in the brain and so forth. I'm down with that. That's fine. But here's the subjective experience. That's what I deal with. And, you know, I didn't dare think this, but I sort of guessed it. It seemed like an encounter with something or someone or some being other than myself. Now, I was an atheist, so I couldn't slap the word God on that and be done with it.
It is a bit of a mystery story. It's a kind of an investigative. What's the word that you used at the beginning of our conversation?
Metaphysical thriller.
A thriller. It is a thriller because you describe kind of your process of trying to investigate this, but also the fact that you, as a very young girl, had kind of written about this to yourself and put that away, you know, through all of your moves, through all of your other books, and have talked about many hard things that a lot of people don't talk about. But somehow you didn't want to talk about this, and I'm wondering why.
I did not want to appear insane. And I'm still afraid of that because, you know, all my life, I never said a word about this. Not to the people closest to me, because it sounds too crazy. That's how I thought. And when I was a teenager, I thought, well, what is this? Is it schizophrenia? Is it, what's going on here? I was afraid of being diagnosed and put into psychiatric care somewhere.
How do you feel now? Now that you've written about it and we're now talking about it?
Well, this is a huge leap. This really took a lot of courage from my part to do this, which may seem silly. But here's what's happening. I'm beginning to hear from people I know very well, saying, my God, that happened to me too. Sorry for the God in that sentence, but I know what you're talking about. We never talk about these things. Now, you give me something that we, quote, never talk about, and I want to start a conversation about it.
How are you with the God idea now?
I'm an atheist. No, this has nothing to do with people's ideas of God, which in our time and culture are mostly of a monotheistic, benevolent God.
Or a judgmental God.
Whatever.
But omnipresent, all-knowing.
But this is, you know, but that assumes something so human-like. I think, as I have studied, and I have studied some of the Christian mystics in preparing to write this book, and I'm not a Christian, I'm not, you know, they describe often an experience not unlike mine. It's not about good or evil.
So why do you call your book Living with a Wild God? Is God just the best name for what you experienced?
I guess I'm pandering to the fundamentalist. Or no, I'm only kidding. No, I just liked that concept. If you could get people away from thinking of God as this person-like creature who is moral. Morality is a human thing. And some animals, I would say, too. But get away from that completely. think of something wild, something that we really don't have the terms and the categories to understand.
Why does one have to get away from it, though? Because you described your atheism as an inheritance, which I mm-hmm. understand, but is it now something that you have embraced for yourself based on your own inquiry, belief, and understanding?
Nothing has ever happened to make me want to believe in the predominant God. Mm-hmm. Nothing. Or polytheistic deities or anything. No.
Well, as we said, it is a thriller, so we don't want to give away the ending, but can I induce you to give us a word of wisdom, some understanding that you would want people to take away from your particular journey?
Well, one would be, you know, it's my father and my parents said, keep asking. Keep asking questions. Never be satisfied with the answers you get. Push it further. And don't be afraid of finding out things that don't fit into any established pattern or theory in your brain, in your mind. Be ready to be amazed.
Barbara Ehrenreich is the author of nearly 24 books. Her latest is titled Living with a Wild God, A Non-Believer's Search for the Truth About Everything. She joined us in our studios in Washington, D.C. Barbara Ehrenreich, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure.
So now a word from me. With March Madness over for this year, it's a double for the University of Connecticut. The Huskies won the women's championship last night, a day after the men won their tournament. May I be among the many to congratulate men's star Shabazz Napier, not for leading his team to the men's championship title on Monday night, which he did, or for being named most outstanding player for the effort, which he was. No, I want to salute him for letting us know how he really feels.
Ladies and gentlemen, you're looking at the Hungry Huskies. This is what happens when you ban us last year, 2 years. We worked so hard for it, 2 years and hungry.
Napier was referring to the fact that his program was barred from postseason play last year by the NCAA. That's because of its low scores on something called its academic progress rate, a measure the NCAA is using to determine whether the student side of the student-athlete equation is actually getting any love. Connecticut was the most high-profile team to get what is, in fact, a severe penalty. The ban caused some players to transfer and clearly sparked some bitterness on the part of those players who chose to remain, a bitterness that, in Shabazz Napier's telling, transformed itself into fire in the belly under the guidance of new coach Kevin Ollie. But it turns out that we can take Napier's comment about the Hungry Huskies another way, in a way he probably did not intend. But here he is earlier in the season at a post-game press conference. He was asked about the effort by Northwestern's football players to unionize. Napier said he thought paying student athletes big gobs of money might not be such a great idea because some young guys wouldn't know how to handle it. But he also said this.
I just feel like a student athlete. And, you know, sometimes, like I said, there's hungry nights where I'm not able to eat and but I still got to play up to my, you know, capabilities, and sometimes it's that way. You know, I don't see myself as so much of an employee, but you know, when you see a jersey getting sold, it may not have your last name on it, but when you see a jersey getting sold, things like that, you know, to some credit, you feel like you want something in return.
Can I just tell you, why are we shocked? Napier isn't the first young athlete to point out the hypocrisy of universities getting millions in TV contracts and jersey sales, while students can literally go to bed hungry because they miss cafeteria hours or some other student life mess up and are too broke to buy some food. And oh, by the way, woe betide the athlete who trades an autograph for a pizza and gets caught. Nor is Napier, though, the first young person to miss the forest because of his own particular tree. The reason Connecticut was banned from postseason play was that education is supposed to be that something you get in return for your hours of play, practice, and conditioning that bring glory and millions to your school. If, according to the NCAA measurement, Connecticut is not on track to graduate even half of its players, and by some measures far fewer than that, then somebody has to ask if these student-athletes are really students at all. And if the deal isn't fair, who's going to step in? Whether you like it or not, Shabazz Napier is giving us some bracing testimony about how life looks from where he sits. And from where he sits, playing basketball is what he went to Connecticut to do. And he's holding up his end of the bargain. So it seems fair to ask if the people on the other side of the table are holding up theirs. Finally today, let's end the program on a high note. Today marks 75 years since Marian Anderson, the African-American contralto, took to the steps of the Lincoln Memorial to sing. Anderson was supposed to sing at the Daughters of the American Revolution Constitution Hall, but she was barred from performing there because she was black. Let's listen to a bit of Marian Anderson's performance from April 9, 1939. That was Marian Anderson performing at the Lincoln Memorial 75 years ago today. And we're going to go out on some more of her performance from that day.
Oh, the gospel train, I'm coming. I hear it just at hand. I hear the car wheels rumbling and rolling through the land and get on board.
That's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and you've been listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.
I hear the train coming, she's coming.